or I could give my players ultimate, consistent, every minute, every second presence.
Welcome to Hoop Nerds with Billy Kegler, presented by the Wisconsin Basketball Coaches Association. We talk to coaches, athletes, and more to learn from their stories and apply learning lessons to improve each individual and stimulate growth for your program, team, staff, and self. Follow along as we explore success and failure en route to improving the game of basketball.
Before we jump in today, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to my friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. I've been associated with their products for a few years now, and I'm really impressed by their innovative and user-friendly shooting machines. They also are great people with tremendous customer service. It's no wonder why they have become the preferred choice among top programs around the country and world. I'm very grateful for their support of the show. Make sure to check them out at drdishbasketball.com and at Dr. Dish B-Ball on social media. Be sure to mention WBCA when ordering your next Dr. Dish to save an extra $300 off any commercial purchase. Coach Smart, welcome to the Hoop Nerds podcast.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, let's dive right in. Tell me about the first time you remember coaching and a story that sticks with you from that experience.
Well, first time I coached was, I coached my younger brother, Kyle. My high school coach, one of his sons, Lance, was the same grade as my brother. So I coached those guys. I'm not sure how old I was, probably, you know, a teenager at some point. And I just got a kick out of, you know, the games and seeing those guys have success. I didn't know anything about any of the nuts and bolts that actually went into coaching at that time. But I like the strategy part of it. And I like the, you know, again, seeing guys have success.
You just mentioned strategy there a little bit. Can you tell me about a coaching idea or theory that you had early in your career that over the course of time you changed because you were presented with new information?
I mean, pretty much everything, man. You know, we were just talking about that this morning, actually, a couple of the coaches and I. It used to be, you know, we ran the offense where 20 years ago, you know, the two bigs screened down for, you know, the two wings and the point guard had the ball top and then ball came in and you cut through the paint. And then we used to do something called a dribble up flare, which is still effective today, actually. So flare on one side of the floor, pin down on the other side of the floor. The game has just changed so much, especially from the standpoint of the four spot. Just being so much different. It used to be that was, you know, a lot of guys that now we would play at the five. And, you know, I think because that position has changed so much, the way we play has changed a lot. So a lot of the stuff that we did at that time and even in subsequent years, we've adjusted.
All right. Well, you talked this morning about talking with your players after practice. And I'm curious, outside of X's and O's, what's the thing that you do in your program that you believe makes the biggest impact for your players in their lives going forward outside of basketball?
I think just spending time with them off the court and making sure that they know that we care about them, telling them we love them, telling them about some of the aspects of their development that we really want them to focus on and we want to focus on that have nothing to do with basketball. And also, you're trying to push them to prepare for what life is going to be like when the ball stops bouncing. And it's a fine line because, you know, the guys, especially at this level, are so driven to play basketball as long as they possibly can. You know, just trying to help them think in a non-binary way. That doesn't mean that you can't also prepare for when you get done playing.
So you mentioned they're telling them that you love them. And a friend of mine, J.R. Blunt, who's at Iowa State, has mentioned this to me as well, is using that as something that he tries to get through to them. Can you tell me a little bit about how you get through to a player who's struggling with that concept? Because there's two different sides, the coach and then coach on the court, right? And then coach off the court. And how to balance those with tough love on helping them get what you need out of them from a basketball standpoint, but loving them as a person as well.
Yeah, I actually think that those two things have to go together. I don't really believe in compartmentalizing, if you will. I think sometimes if we send them mixed messages in terms of like one message on the court and another message off the court, that actually can be counterproductive. So to me, it needs to be a holistic approach towards their development. If it's tough love on the court, it needs to be tough love off the court. If it's relationship-based off the court, it needs to be relationship-based on the court. At the same time, they need to understand, hey, every time we take the floor, we're trying to grow and develop and do the right thing for our team. It's a team sport. So if you let your guy drive by you five times in a row, then you probably got to come out of the game. And I think at the end of the day, guys actually appreciate that accountability because they do want to get better. It just takes some maturing to get them to appreciate it in the moment.
Okay, you hit on defense there and driving by five times in a row, which is a big no-no. So before we dive a little bit deeper, can you give us a brief description of your defensive philosophy on the court?
How much time do you have? That's a long one.
That's why I use the word brief.
Okay, brief. I'll just give you our three defensive foundations then. And they are violence, multiple efforts, and deflections. Let me clarify violence because I don't want to confuse anyone. It does not mean fighting. It does not mean even fouling, although sometimes guys will cross the line and foul. It just means playing with a nastiness, a toughness, and aggressiveness that gives you that physical edge. Everybody talks about the game of football being about violence. I think the most violent basketball players have a huge advantage, particularly on the defensive end, also on the offensive end. A guy like Davion Mitchell played for Baylor last year, now plays for the Sacramento Kings. You know, he just wins his matchup by being the more violent guy. And sometimes that's going after the ball harder. Sometimes that's putting his chest on a guy when he tries to drive. Sometimes that's blowing up a ball screen. But that's a big part of what we're trying to instill here at Marquette in our first year. Multiple efforts is, as you know, basketball is not a single effort sport. You know, it's about doing one thing and the next and the next and the next. And the best players are really, really good at that. And then deflections, to me, it's the number one stat that correlates to winning. Bigger than any offensive stat, any other defensive stat, the amount of times you get your hand on the basketball. Since I've been a head coach, we've won every single game. Except for one, we lost one time when we got 32 or more deflections in a 40-minute game. And we've won over 100 that way. So it's been a pretty steady statistic for us. So we really try to emphasize getting our hands on the basketball.
So all of those components, I would believe, play into a little bit of pressing, playing the whole length of the court, trying to increase the tempo, have more opportunities for deflections and multiple efforts because you're using the whole length of the court rather than half the court. Can you talk to me a little bit about pressing on a make versus pressing on a miss and which you prefer, or maybe both of them?
Well, the good thing about those three defensive foundations is they apply to any type of defense. So they apply to half court man-to-man, certainly pressing man or zone press. You can play zone defense. Jim Boeheim's great Syracuse teams, if you look at them, they probably play in that zone with some type of violence, whatever it is for them, whether it's closing out or the way that they rebound out of the zone. Certainly multiple efforts, are a big component and getting your hands in the basketball. So absolutely it applies to pressing. You mentioned pressing on makes and misses. To me, I think pressing on misses, field goal misses is you got to be really, really sold out on that. I mean, I think it can be good, but it's got to be something that you pretty much practice and do almost all the time. Because if you think about it, it basically goes against your normal transition defense principles, which is run the hell back. And so we don't press on misses. We've never really pressed on misses except for free throw misses. Free throws are different because, it's a set situation. You can put guys exactly where you want them to be. So actually pressing on a free throw miss is one of the best times to press. because they get the rebound usually with the big guy, and the clock has already started. The 10-second count has already started, and it's a great way to kind of catch a team not necessarily in their proper press attack or their press attack alignment, and to maybe get a 10-second call on them.
And let's just clarify, you're not condoning your players missing free throws so you can get into that situation.
Not at all. No, we'd rather get the points on the board and then press on the make. But it is a good kind of momentum shift if you did miss, which is demoralizing, obviously, to miss a free throw, particularly like a front end of a one-on-one. But then if you can turn them back over, or if you can, you know, whether it's a 10-second call or you can do something that's disruptive to them, and it can get you kind of to the next thing. All right, you missed a free throw. That sucks. But we're moving on, and, you know, we're going to be aggressive here in the press.
All right, so if you're going to press in a man-to-man situation, do you rely on your players having their specific matchup, or do you put players in positions on the court so they can match up with the closest body and go from there? What is your thought process on the most effective way to do that with your team?
You can do either. Most coaches would say it's easier just to play a matchup, you know, where guys are in specific spots on the floor, because then they can just run to that spot and find the closest guy. I'm probably in the minority. I like finding your man. I want my best on-ball defender on a certain guy. And I also like to fight the ball coming inbounds if we're going to press man-to-man. But it requires you to be really good at transitions. And that's something that we practice the heck out of. I would say at Marquette, we are a long way from where we want to be eventually with our transitions. And when I say transitions, literally going from any one thing to the next. So literally getting done talking to my player downstairs to coming up to this Zoom call was the transition. So just trying to get the guys to understand, hey, if we want to be good, we're going to have to transition faster. And what you're talking about, finding your man and getting matched up, that's a really key transition if you're going to press that way.
As many listeners know, I spent over 6 years as a general manager at Just the Game Fieldhouse in Wisconsin Dells. I was able to spend time talking hoops with coaches like Tom Izzo, along with high school and youth coaches, in addition to meeting some basketball legends, including my childhood favorite, Sam Elke, who is in the WBCA Hall of Fame and High School Basketball Museum, located at Just the Game Fieldhouse, which is a must visit for any true hoop nerd. They also play host to the WBCA All-Star Games and Coaches Clinic every year. Just the Game hosts over 70 basketball and volleyball tournaments annually and is a great place to play for teams of all ages and ability levels. You can't beat all Wisconsin Dells has to offer in your free time. The Fieldhouse also has two sister companies in Just the Game Impressions and Just the Game Live. Just the Game Impressions specializes in customized screen printing and embroidery and promotional products. They serve businesses, schools, sports teams, and more. Just the Game Live takes pride in providing affordable and simple live streaming solutions for venues or programs of all kinds. Inquire today for more information. For more info on everything Just the Game has to offer, check them out at justthegamefieldhouse.com.
Sideline Interactive delivers digital and LED scoring tables and video boards that generate excitement in your gym and the ultimate game day experience for your players and fans. We provide you the blueprint and the game plan to generate $10,000 or more in sponsorship revenue every year. 95% of our schools generate enough advertising dollars during the first school year to pay for their purchase. Any school or college can qualify for no fee, no interest financing over 2 school years. We're ready and able to deliver your order to you within 3 to 4 weeks. The tables and boards can be used for any indoor sport, as well as watching game film, school assemblies, signing days, or any other event that is held in your gym. Visit sidelineinteractive.com or call 832-786-0302 to schedule a 15 to 30 minute live web demo to see our tables and boards in action and what these fantastic products can do for you. Or email sales@sidelineinteractive.com. A link to sidelineinteractive.com is in the show notes for today's episode.
So you mentioned they're fighting getting the ball in. Do you prefer having a player on the inbounder, or would you rather have that player off assisting with one of maybe the guards denying them the entry? Which way do you prefer to go?
Both. Either way. I mean, it depends. I like switching it up. You know, I think the best teams that utilize full court pressure, they give teams different looks. So I would most of the time like having a guy on the ball so that he can be what we call 10 toes, which is 10 toes on the baseline, madman, going nuts, active, trying to get a deflection. But then particularly in a set situation like a dead ball coming out of a timeout or another situation where the ball's dead, I like to turn around with that inbounder and then try to take away maybe their number one ball handling threat, make them inbound it to someone else.
So I like the way you're saying both, because it gives you diversity here and you can switch it up. Now I'm curious about that communication process with your team. Do you stick with a call until there's a dead ball, stop ball situation or timeout, as you just mentioned, or are you able to, or do you want to communicate on the fly with your team?
Usually the guys will know what we're in. We have a particular press here, like currently right now, that we like after normal field goal makes. And then any of the other ones would be a call, whether it's coming out of a timeout situation or, you know, in a free throw huddle, you might call something different. That being said, if we're in that press, whatever it is, let's say it's our diamond press, and we're able to turn them over, force a quick shot, and then go down and score, then we're going to get right back in that same press. Because I think it can be a real force multiplier if you're able to, you know, create a positive play on defense, score out of it, and then stay in the same defense. In other words, the guy's energy is going to be stronger and better as you go if you're able to have those positive plays.
Yeah, I've always loved scoring in transition and being in a denial mode right away because you're increasing the pressure. And I love that you just mentioned that there. And you keep walking me into my next question. So you mentioned diamond. And you talked about madman being on the ball. What is the most difficult position in that diamond press that one of your players has to play?
Probably that madman position. And then what we call center field, which is normally the point guard. The madman's difficult because, I mean, you just got to go nuts. And it's a different alignment than when we're matched up man to man. In diamond, we want our madman to be angled and cut the floor in half, so that the inbounder cannot throw the long diagonal pass. That pass is on the madman. He's got to take that pass away with great activity. And then, you know, when the ball comes in, he's going to be the trapper. He's going to be one of the two guys in the trap. And diamond, he's always in the trap. If there's a trap, he's in it. Then if they pass out of the trap, if we're able to get a second trap up the second side, he's in that too. So just a lot of activity is required from that position. And then the center field is a challenging spot because you've got to be on the ball side, taking away the pass up the sideline. But then you've got to, when the ball side changes, you've got to change sides, but you got to have the feel of understanding, I got to hold here for a second so that they don't throw this diagonal pass and let my teammate, who's now the weak side wing, sprint back. So there's some nuance there to that position for sure.
So you just listed the characteristic of feel with that center field position. Is that something you can teach, or is that a characteristic that that player has innately?
I think both. I think that some guys are innately good at it. You know, some guys are, you know, just like if you put a guy at free safety, you know, on the football field without it, teaching them, some guys just have a really good feel. But it's also about reps. It's about experience. It's about learning what the offense is going to do, learning tendencies, and, you know, trusting yourself to be able to make the right read, trusting your instincts.
So the center field person you mentioned was your point guard. Is that an exact always has to be my point guard, or do you rely on maybe a player who has a little bit more ability or experience, as you just mentioned it, to be in that position? Which way do you go with it?
That's a good question. I mean, you can go either way. You know, when I was at Clemson as an assistant coach, we played diamond a ton. One of the years, my first year there, it was our primary press. And we used it so much that we had like 3, 4, 5 different kind of change-ups that we could use. So one of the things that we changed up sometimes is, depending on the press offense or the press inbounds, those three guys up front were interchangeable. So the two wings and the center fielder were somewhat interchangeable. So any of those three guys could in essence, become the center fielder. But I think the more nuance you get with it and the more different variations, obviously, the more complicated it is, the more time you got to spend on it. So for us, because we have a bunch of other presses, I would rather just, you know, a few guys just kind of learn that spot, and that's where they're going to play.
All right, let's go into scouting report mode and let's switch to the other side. Which offensive approach to press attack versus your defense is the most difficult for you and your teams to press against?
I mean, it depends. That's why it's good to use various presses. So there's a very, very specific press inbounds that's good against Diamond. I can't tell you because this is being recorded right now, but that press inbounds, if they do that, maybe feeds into a little bit what we want them to do against more of a man-to-man press. So it depends on which one you're talking about, but I'll tell you the generic answer, good guards. I mean, that's the best press attack against any press. If you got 2-3, you know, good passers, good ball handlers, guys that make good decisions, and you have a team that understands what to do when you get trapped, then you can turn pressing into an advantage. You know, it can be something where you say, hey, they're going to press us. Great. That means they're not back. They're not set. And we're going to create an advantage out of it.
Yeah. Attacking on offense rather than feel like you're being attacked with the defense is the way to go. Well, I'm going to get you out of here with more lighthearted non-basketball question. Use your imagination. If you could have one superhero power, what would that superhero power be and what would you do with it?
Well, I'll give you an answer that is probably different than what anyone else would say, because I don't even know if this is a superhero power that any of the superheroes we read about in comic books or see on movies have. But I would say presence. Like if I could have, or I could give my players ultimate, consistent, every minute, every second presence, to me, that's as powerful as anything.
So I have to ask a follow-up. How do you teach presence to your players, or how are you attempting to teach presence to your players?
Well, that's a long answer. I'll try to sum it up. I think, first of all, helping them understand when they are present and when they aren't, just so that they know, you know, what it feels like, and specific to basketball, what they play like when they are, as we say, lost in the fight, and then what they play like or what it feels like when they're caught up in the past or the future. You know, we do mindfulness techniques. We do meditation before every practice. We actually have a mental skills coach that works with our guys on, you know, different techniques to help them to be more present. But as you probably remember, when you were 18 to 22 years old, you know, easier said than done. And I think for even those of us that are older, it's something you have to work on every day. And sometimes you lose sight of it. That's why I told you if I could have one superpower, that's what it would be.
No, I love that. And one quote that I love is distance provides clarity. And you mentioned the 18 to 22 year old range. If I could go back and tell myself some things, man, that would be a whole different world out there for me. Coach Smart, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the information and sharing with us on the Hoop Nerds.
Well, thanks for having me on. And I do want to say, I appreciate hearing about Madison College. When I was a kid, it was MATC. And I'll never forget the summer league games that we played there.
Do you still have your t-shirts?
I don't, but those were like my prized possessions. I remember one summer I played on two teams in the summer league there. And so I had two different jerseys, and it was 1992. So I had a number 9 jersey, because if you remember, those jerseys were not like typical high school numbers. Mm-hmm. So I had a number 9 jersey, and that was Michael Jordan's Olympic number. So I was excited about that. And then I had a number 5 jersey, and number 5 was Jalen Rose at Michigan, part of the Fab Five. And they were light blue. And man, like those 2 days of the week going to MATC to play in a summer league, nothing better. Couldn't beat it. And then my other big memory was this was a few years later, there was a big, big 3-on-3 tournament in the parking lot there across the street from the main building. And man, a huge fight broke out, but we were able to kind of weather that storm and we won the 3-on-3 tournament. So that's what I remember about MATC.
Beautiful. I'm glad I could take you down memory lane a little bit. And I remember all those things you're talking about because I went through them as a kid as well. All right. Thanks, Coach.
Thanks for having me.